years ago, 211 years ago, in 1809, on February 12th, Charles Darwin was born in Shrewsbury, England. His mother and his father had been raised Unitarian, and he and his siblings regularly attended the local Unitarian chapel with their mother. As a young man, he attended the University of Edinburgh. After all, his father was a doctor, and he was kind of expected to be the same. He found it dreadfully boring. The lectures were dull, and surgery didn't interest him, so his father sent him to Cambridge to study for the ministry. He wasn't much more interested in studying there, although he did discover beetle collecting. He developed a deep curiosity about nature, and he spent many hours exploring, probably more hours exploring than going to class. He did graduate, but he had no interest in ministry. Only the natural world called him. In his 20s, Darwin spent 5 years as a naturalist on a ship called the HMS Beagle, and while it's best known for the work he did in the Galapagos, it actually circled the globe. He collected specimens and bones and rocks, pondered how animals change over time, explored barnacles and coral atolls, and eventually developed what we now call the theory of evolution. When he got back to England, he began publishing his observations. He was a very scientific person. When he got back to England, he also began to contemplate whether or not he wanted to get married. So he made a list of 2 sheets of paper. One said married, one said not married. On the one that said married, one of the things that was written down was that he would have a companion in old age. And it would be better than a dog. On the one for not married, the one that was biggest was less money for books. Somehow marriage went out, and he did marry Emma Wedgwood, who was a practicing Unitarian. Although later, when his wife and his children, they actually had 10, I think 7 lived through adulthood. When they attended church, he only went occasionally, mostly he took walks in the countryside. In 1859, at the age of 50, Darwin published a book called The Origin of the Species by Means of Natural Selection, arguably one of the most influential and controversial books ever published. The natural world clearly fascinated him, and Darwin's impact is profound. He died in 1803 and is buried in Westminster Abbey, next to Isaac Newton, actually, but his work lives on. Almost a century earlier, in 1733, Joseph Priestley was born, also in England. As a young man, he decided to be a minister. They didn't agree with the dominant Calvinist beliefs, so he attended a dissenting seminary. By the time he graduated, his theology was pretty solidly Unitarian. He settled in a pulpit, and he taught school part-time, and neither went well. The combined pay was barely enough to survive on, and his congregation did not like his unorthodox theology. He continued his scientific explorations, though. At the urging of his good friend Benjamin Franklin, he actually published a book called The History and Present State of Electricity. Later, at the age of 33, he was called to another congregation. By this time, his theology was decidedly Unitarian. It is reported that the house at his new church was right next to a brewery, and that that's what got him thinking about chemistry again. So he began experimenting. Priestley is credited with the discovery of oxygen as well as a means of curing scurvy. He developed an early anesthesia. He found a way to measure the purity of air. Even invented pencil erasers. He continued to serve as a minister during the years of his scientific discoveries, and he taught at a Unitarian school for training ministers. In 1782, Priestley published a book called The History of the Corruption of Christianity. He also began a campaign to grant full rights to dissenting religious groups, such as Unitarians. And he became an open supporter of the French Revolution. All of this was too much for many of his fellow Englishmen, and in 1794 they burned his lab and his home to the ground. He fled for his life, and he eventually resettled in America, in the Philadelphia area. There he helped the Universalists to raise money to complete a church they were building, and he also helped to found 2 different Unitarian congregations. Priestley authored over 25 books and numerous articles of religious and scientific writings. One of them actually includes a description of Benjamin Franklin's famous kite experiment. Priestley died in 1804 and was buried near the city of Philadelphia. These are two famous and tremendously influential people. Two people who are part of our own Unitarian heritage, whose lives were influenced by the faith that we share. I mentioned them this morning and talk about the connection with religion and science of which they are part, as part of something called a clergy letter project, along with well over 1,200 clergy in a broad cross-section of religions in our country. Many Unitarian Universalists, certainly, but also UCC clergy and Methodists, American Baptists and Episcopalians, Jewish rabbis and many others. It's a truly interfaith organization. The Clergy Letter Project was started 15 years ago in Wisconsin when a group of clergy from many faiths began a protest against a school board which was seeking to prevent the teaching of evolution. Its purpose was to remind the general public that many religions see evolution as an essential part of science, fully harmonious with active religious faith, and it began an annual evolution weekend near the anniversary of Darwin's birth, which is this weekend. This year, the organization is also urging its members to address climate change, which I will do this morning. Their materials describe some of their efforts. Evolution Weekend is an opportunity for serious discussion and reflection on the relationship between religion and science. The goal is to show that religion and science are not adversaries. Rather, they simply look at the natural world from different perspectives and ask and answer different questions. Religious people from diverse faith traditions understand that science is not the enemy. It does not in any way threaten or demean or diminish their faith in God by whatever name. In fact, for many, the wonders of science enhance and deepen their awe and gratitude for the Holy. Our own Unitarian Universalist history makes clear our respect for and our commitment to science. Darwin and Priestley were scientists whose work was nourished at least in part by their religious roots, which encouraged curiosity and liked questions, and who did not see scientific exploration as being at all opposed to religious truth. Our fifth source counsels us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science. Unitarianism grew from the use of reason to examine and interpret the scriptures, and scientific exploration has been important since our founding. Michael Servetus, our first Unitarian martyr, was himself a doctor and the first one who described the pulmonary circulatory system. Our faith has always made room for science, and even some other religions have tried to deny it. At a time when many public voices seem to be trying to discount science and ignore science discoveries, it is especially important that religious voices speak up. For centuries, in some quarters, science and religion have been at loggerheads, and religion has often sought to stifle science. The books of Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo were all banned for that radical suggestion that planets orbited the sun and not our Earth. Their ideas were declared heretical and an anathema to receive biblical doctrine. And 100 years ago or so, when Wegener began to talk about continental drift, he was widely shunned and ridiculed. Again, the Bible said nothing about continents moving around, so how could such a preposterous idea be true? In the past few years, there have been very public efforts to discredit science in many ways, often from religious perspectives. Healthcare policies try to ignore scientific studies of causes or outcomes. Policies have been formed as to where to drill for oil or gas with no consideration to environmental or cultural impact. Most pertinent to today's topic, energy and environmental policies have been proposed and even implemented that intentionally reject any concept of climate change, even as scientists and lay people around the world feel its effects. Science has become suspect. But melting ice caps, devastating hurricanes, terrible droughts in some areas and rising sea waters in others, both of which threaten the lives of millions, all of these demonstrate that our climate is surely changing, and no amount of censoring the words climate change will alter that fact. We may debate the exact causes of climate change, or how much came from what source, or who should do what about it, but the change is still there. Science has documented and re-examined over and over. So what does that have to do with religion? I use a long excerpt based on a sermon preached about 30 years ago by Reverend Scott Alexander, which explains it, I think, better than I could. He writes about a very small, important book entitled Blessed Assurance, At Home with a Bomb in Amarillo, Texas. It was written in 1986 by a woman named Grace Mochabai. The book is a study of attitudes about nuclear weapons in Amarillo, Texas, which is the location of a massive weapons facility called Pantex, which is still the final assembly point for all American nuclear warheads. The question that haunted the author was how a deeply religious town like Amarillo has about 160,000 people in over 200 churches. How could it exist so comfortably with what she calls a factory of doom? She was amazed at the equanimity with which most Amarillans seem to take the presence of so many nuclear weapons right in their midst. Puzzled by how residents could accept a potential Holocaust in their town, where any accident would certainly cost thousands of lives, Mochabai stumbled on a startling hypothesis. One day she heard a song through an open window. It was a popular hymn that says that when the end of the world comes, all true believers will rise up to heaven in a blissful rapture, exempt from the suffering that will befall the rest of humanity. Mochabai began to focus her study on various preachers throughout the city. She found that many were proclaiming something called end-time thinking, the theological belief that the end of the world is coming soon, and that a nuclear holocaust or other destruction will just, perhaps blessedly, put an end to human sin and suffering when the true believers are lifted out. This is the doctrine found in the book of Revelation, which promises that God's elect, the true and righteous, will literally be raptured out. They'll be lifted off the face of the earth and directly swept up to heaven before the rest of humanity, all of us. Left on earth will be afflicted with sores and drought and seas of blood, and finally a great holocaust of fire. And that's what it says. Mochabai quotes one minister, and remember this was written in 1986, who said, "The world as we know it will probably end by 1990. It's settled and sealed by the word of God. It won't be long before God puts a cataclysmic end to this soiled creation." Here in Amarillo, he continues, people live happily even though we know the bomb could drop at any moment. As long as you are right with God, you do not need to worry. He and many others across America are saying not to fear nuclear weapons or nuclear war. For if the Holocaust happens, they and their families, protected by their correct theological beliefs, will be selectively saved by the rapture. So ends the excerpt from Alexander's sermon. In recent years, this thinking has been extended to climate change as well. For some, saving our planet doesn't matter because the rapture will soon pull all of the believers out of the world anyway. That's actually the theology I was raised with. Solving the conflict in the Middle East or addressing racial inequity, alleviating deep poverty, the plight of immigrants, none of that really matters. There is even a strong strain of thought that suggests that the rapture cannot happen until a certain level of chaos and calamity has been reached, almost a bring-it-on mentality. Science is of little use, and social justice work has little point, since it won't affect the believers. Only a correct, narrow understanding of the Bible as interpreted through a particular lens matters. This is the strain of religion that explicitly denies science to the detriment of all of us. I want to stress that there is a wide variety of views of science among religions. As I mentioned earlier, clergy who are part of the Clergy Letter Project or several other organizations come from many different religious traditions. Many of our most powerful social action participants come from that same cross-section of religions. We unions are not alone. On some issues, we've been in the forefront. We were in the vanguard in ordaining women and gays and lesbians. We've been very active in the fight for LGBTQ rights and in immigration issues. But we're not alone. We're one of many. However, as individuals and congregations and as a denomination, we have a long history of involvement in a wide variety of social justice issues. We're not alone. As I said, we're not the only faith. And we haven't been flawless in our practices. But sometimes we do have an impact on Unitarian Universalists. We might even sometimes set an example. A Methodist colleague once laughed to me that it would be easy to identify the UU Church in any town in America on any Sunday morning, even if there was no outside indication of any denomination. The UU Church, he said, would be the one with the highest percentage of Priuses and other hybrid vehicles parked outside, and the one with solar panels on the roof. I hope he's right. I do think that in general, UUs are aware of climate change and attentive to what we can do about it. But it's not just us, and we're not perfect at it, although many of us try to do our part. Changing the light bulbs in our churches and our homes matters. Using reusable shopping bags matters, and rejecting single-use plastics. Tiny things that can make a difference, like that 1 5-year-old child helping to push the car. Many are seeing these small changes that so many UUs, so many Americans, so many people all around the world have made matters. But none of these actions in themselves will save the world. And our faith and even our country is not always leading the changes. We have much to learn from other places. I was stunned back in 2013 to be told as the tour group that I was on approached the border of Rwanda. Who knew that our truck would be searched and single-use plastic bags would be confiscated? We were told that the authorities probably wouldn't search every single individual suitcase we were on a truck with, 16 or whatever of us, although they did stop and search every private vehicle that was entering Rwanda. But we were told that they might spot check, and they did. Any single-use plastic bags on the racks above were confiscated, and they went through several suitcases, and they took what they found. When we crossed the border, we noticed a striking difference from other countries we've been through. No plastic bags blew across the fields or stuck in over fences. Many fewer plastic bottles lying in the ditches. Rwanda, 7 years ago, had already begun taking action that many of our cities and towns are only now looking at and some still resist. The impact of simple things like plastic bags and bottles on our world is clear. But change is not easy, even though it's essential. Even as island nations like Tuvalu or the Marshall Islands are slowly engulfed by the sea, maybe disappearing, Marshall Islands is currently thinking about relocating, I think it's 55,000 people, because the country is literally disappearing. And still some refuse to acknowledge that there's any reason to take action. Millions of people in India and Bangladesh, Thailand and Vietnam and other countries live on land that will be below predicted annual coastal flood levels in just a few decades. And it seems like every week there's new and more horrific news about the disappearing of ice caps. Pollution in many cities in India and China and Pakistan is so bad that breathing itself presents a health hazard. And the impact of climate change is not just in far-off lands. Rising sea levels threaten New York and Miami. Temperatures in Phoenix continue to soar even as the water table drops. And higher temperatures contribute to increasing fires in California. None of these situations will be easy to address. Using science will help, though, both in forecasting accurately and in guiding the changes in our behavior that are needed around the world to mitigate the damage. Our world is one world, we will see in a few minutes, and it's true, perhaps more than ever. What touches one affects us all. What each person does matters, and so do the policies and practices that each country follows. The rapid spread of the coronavirus clearly illustrates how tightly the web of interconnection is woven. A few months ago, we'd never heard of this virus. And now it's infected thousands and killed hundreds. And last I checked, it was in over two dozen countries already. Our world is struggling, and we're struggling with it. There's nothing new about struggle in the world, but the causes and the implications are different. Denying these changes will not help. Scientific research and awareness might if we use what we know and work together. Which takes me back to the importance of lifting our voices as religious people to address social justice issues. We will not change the world alone, but our voices can join with those of many other faiths, and with many who claim no particular faith but still care deeply about these issues. Probably one of the many forces that has helped to bring about such a sea change in our country's attitudes towards LGBT issues in the last decade or so is the number of churches of so many denominations that have begun to fly rainbow flags. They form a united visual voice, declaring that their religion, their various understandings of God and the Holy itself, believes that all sexual orientations are valid and welcome. They sent these messages as religious bodies, and they quite effectively counter religions that teach differently. Advocacy and sermons, study groups and marches all helped further the change, but that simple symbol, that voice raised by so many faiths, claimed by so many religions, visually reminded people that their views mattered a lot too. There are plenty of religious voices that call climate change a hoax or believe addressing it is irrelevant. We Unitarian Universalists can, I would suggest that our faith says we must, be among the religious voices who speak otherwise. Religious voices have been tremendously powerful in the past. We witnessed Martin Luther King's use of the pulpit in the service of civil rights, or the influence of so many clergy and other religious people in opposing the Vietnam War. It is time to use the power of religious voice once again, claiming science and the results of scientific study, demanding that public officials listen and consider scientific research, fighting through the courts when science is ignored, choosing who we vote for based on their views about utilizing science, and insisting that science be included in our schools. All of these matter. A study by the Pew Research Center in 2014 indicates that those who believe the Bible is literally true and who hold the most traditional views of God are the most likely to say that environmental regulations are not needed. Maybe no surprise. But we religious liberals can raise a different voice. Interestingly, those who believe most strongly in God and those who express the strongest doubt or disinterest in God hold an equally strong belief that the world is often a place of wonder. Those two extremes have a similar view, stronger than any of those in the question is, what should be done to protect this world, this place of wonder? A scientifically based belief that the world will continue on, that our grandchildren and their grandchildren will inhabit the world that we leave to them, encourages us Unitarian Universalists and many others to make use of science to ensure that the world we live in, the world that we leave for those next generations, is as livable and as wonderful as it is for those that are here now. Science for Unitarian Universalists and so many others is not the enemy, but a tool that we must use in our own lives, and that we must insist be considered in making public decisions and in setting public policy. Scientists like Darwin and Priestley and Servetus and others are part of our legacy, and that legacy is ours to pass on. May we be willing to work to see that this is so. May we use our liberal understanding of what is holy to enter public debate and raise our religious voices on the side of science. Amen. We'll wait a moment and then have a short response time.